privilege to be with you tonight. You're sort of scattered to the four corners here, so I'll try to maintain some eye contact with all of you because I think that's important for any audience. And I do appreciate your coming out on a Tuesday night for a special event like this. It is special because we're at Calvary. I'm grateful for Chad's invitation. My wife Joan is with me tonight, and it's really Joan to whom I owe the privilege of being introduced to the Chronicles of Narnia. And so whenever she's with me, I always want to give her that credit, because I was one of those folks who really loved C.S. Lewis and loved the hardcore apologetics, and since I had written a dissertation on Lewis's literary criticism, I was into all of his fact-based historical research. And a couple of years into that, Joan said, well, you know, you really ought to take a look at the Chronicles. I said, oh, I'll get around to it, but, you know, they're kind of for kids, and you know, I'll get to them. And at that time, we hadn't had any children of our own, and so there wasn't that motivation. But she eventually prevailed, and they have become really the heart of what I love about Lewis and his work. I would like to share a little bit of that with you tonight. I really have in mind four parts over about 45 minutes, and then leaving some time for some questions and answers. I'm hoping you'll be able to answer my questions about Lewis, because all of you, I'm sure, are well-read in Lewis, and you've come out to an event like this with some knowledge and some experience, and I'd like to take advantage of that. We'll do a brief introduction to Prince Caspian as a sort of sequel to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. We'll talk about the life and work of C.S. Lewis and why he's worth even meeting to talk about at an event like this. Then we'll spend most of the rest of our time with sort of a thematic look at the book, Prince Caspian. And then we'll leave a little bit of time toward the end. I want to share just a few thoughts about the movie that has come out about Prince Caspian. And then we'll have Q&A. You may indulge me the possibility of looking at and perhaps even purchasing a book I've written about Narnia that will be on display in the forum out here. It's a book called Not a Tame Lion, and it's about the Chronicles of Narnia and sort of the biblical foundation for the stories and why they hold together and make sense. And all the proceeds from that sale will go to a mission that my son Justin in Nairobi, Kenya, is operating. So if you're worried about, oh, this fellow's kind of blown into Glendale Avenue and he's got a book to sell and so forth, it's all going to Justin, who works on a humanitarian bridge-building project for remote villages and also is starting a school. So I will get that into his hands. Okay, are you ready to go a bit further up and further in with Lewis? I have never met anybody who told me that Prince Caspian was their favorite chronicle. Now, there may be somebody in the audience tonight who will disabuse me of that notion, but I think there are some reasons why Prince Caspian isn't often mentioned as the favorite out of the seven possible choices. And I'll go into some reasons for that in a moment. But let's point out the fact that Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is really a hard act to follow. When you think about the momentous themes of sacrifice, resurrection, redemption that are on display in that book, and you can see why Prince Caspian might seem to be a letdown from that work. In fact, you might even say, and if you'll forgive me the pun, that Prince Caspian sort of dwarfed by Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. You think about it, there are some really wonderful encounters in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Starting with Professor Kirk, the magic wardrobe that they find their way into, and that great soliloquy of Professor Kirk, logic, why don't they teach logic in these schools today? And setting us up for a faith journey that is really enriching and fulfilling. Then there's Mr. Beaver introducing Aslan, the great king, to the children, and they're all worried about meeting Aslan, and Susan sort of says, well, then he isn't safe. And Mr. Beaver says, "Safe? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you." Then there's the stone table and Aslan being tied up and ridiculed and mocked by the White Witch and her gruesome crew, and his death. But then the triumphant resurrection, and then the triumphant coronation scenes, and then at the very end of that book, Mr. Beaver, as an aside, says, "He'll be coming and going. One day you'll see him and another you won't. He doesn't like being tied down. He's wild, you know. Not like a tame lion." So maybe you can agree with me, with great lines like that and great themes, momentous themes, theologically weighty themes, that Prince Caspian might seem to be a little lightweight. Now, as I've grown, and Aslan gets bigger and bigger to me as I see him depicted in fiction, I've come to appreciate Prince Caspian for its own merits, and we'll be getting into those in a moment. But let me just preface it by saying this is the only Narnian Chronicle that Lewis specifically wrote as a sequel. In fact, it's the only Narnian Chronicle with a subtitle, The Return to Narnia, as if he had to tell us. And it's what we might call a bridge novel. It's a novel designed to set us up for the rest of the adventures that would come to the Pevensey children and their kin, and you might say to us as we move through all seven. And so it's very important in the sequence of things, and it's quite crucial for us to understand the heart of this book. What we learn is that timing is everything, and that the timing belongs to Aslan, and that our role is to think and live faithfully to the character of Aslan as we move through Narnia. And we learn what happens when that is forgotten. So that's at the heart of Prince Caspian. We'll come back to that. But I want to say something about C.S. Lewis, Jack Lewis, to his friends. I've had the privilege of reading Lewis for about 40 years. And have had the even greater privilege of spending time in Oxford and Cambridge, where he lived and taught, even being able to live and teach in his own home called the Kilns outside of Oxford, a very special privilege. But Lewis would be the first to tell you that it's not him to which our attention should be drawn. Lewis's life bears witness to the grace and mercy of Jesus Christ. And so when we talk about Lewis tonight, and as we call attention to his works, we're not calling attention to some infallible human writer. We're looking at the life and work of a man who loved Jesus and points us to him, both in his fiction and in his nonfiction. And it's a privilege to gather people, in my view, to talk about the works of Lewis for that reason. And he would be humbled that there are people still reading his works, making movies out of them, and willing to come out on a Tuesday night in Toledo, Ohio to think about him and his work. Now, it's somewhat taken for granted today that a Christian writer could be a best-selling author. I mean, we have seen in the last 20 years the appetite for Christians and non-Christians to read works of worthy, faith-building knowledge. Whether we're talking about somebody like Rick Warren or fiction like Lewis's. But when Lewis began to write, he was an Oxford professor of English. And even the genre of science fiction and fantasy, which we again take for granted as a genre, a medium by which we can instill spiritual truths and build up all ages in thinking about transcendent, heavenly pictures. Well, when Lewis started doing this, he was virtually the only one. He and his friend J.R.R. Tolkien, whom many of you would also have read and have seen movies made of his works. When Lewis created his original works, science fiction works, and then later the Chronicles of Narnia, he did it with a deliberate desire as he put it, to smuggle past watchful dragons the truths of the gospel. Now, you don't have to be a Christian to read and enjoy the Chronicles of Narnia or to enjoy the movies. But if you are, you will see, you will have the opportunity to see at least, a very rich tapestry of Christian truth portrayed in a different realm and maybe reflecting back on our world, the truths that are found in both. And that was always Lewis's intention. But if you know anything about Lewis's biography, and I just want to spend a little bit of time on this presently, you know that as a young adult, he was the least likely person ever to succumb to the gospel, because he had grown up very embittered by an experience he had as a young man of losing his mother at age 9. And it was a particularly embittered experience for Lewis because he had been brought up as a Christian and in a Christian home where people prayed for healing. And he fervently prayed that his mother would be healed of what was cancer. And she was not. And at age 9, Lewis embarked upon about a 20-year alienation from God, where he was not just an ordinary unbeliever, he was an ardent atheist whose personal experience of losing his mother and then kind of doubly losing his father, because his father never recovered from the loss of his wife and sent the boys, Lewis and his brother Warney, off to boarding school, where Lewis basically was tortured by that experience in the ways that boarding schools in England at the time that he was there in the early teens of the 20th century could only experience beatings and bullying. And Lewis retreated in his imagination to the world of fantasy, fairy tale, mythology. Little did he know that God himself was preparing Lewis for a role he could not have imagined, using those very things that were a retreat from the day-to-day and the pain and the physical intimidation of where he was living. He would use that myth, that fairy tale, that fantasy world to which he had retreated to be a medium by which he would communicate his faith. As he comes to put it, God is not safe, but he is good. And Lewis understood that. Lewis always writes out of a very profound gratitude to God for that experience. No one would wish it upon themselves, but it introduced him to a lifelong pursuit of joy. In fact, some of you know his autobiography is entitled Surprised by Joy. It has a double meaning in Lewis's life, as you realize, because he eventually married somebody named Joy, Joy Davidman. But Lewis's life is a testimony to the fact that God will prepare you for greater things if you will yield to him. And that's exactly what happened when Lewis reached his 29th year. And he confessed that God was God and came to Christ. Now, if Amy, you could put up this quote, and I'm not sure if you can read it, but I'll read it to you. It comes from Mere Christianity, and it sums up, I think, what Lewis is all about and what the Chronicles of Narnia try to do. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing. If that is so, I must take care, on the one hand, never to despise or be unthankful for these earthly blessings, and on the other, never to mistake them for the something else of which they are only a kind of copy or echo or mirage. I must keep alive in myself the desire for my true country, which I shall not find till after death. I must never let it get snowed under or turned aside. I must make it the main object of life to press on to that other country. and to help others to do the same. Now, that's exactly what Lewis is trying to do in all of his post-conversion works, but particularly in the Chronicles of Narnia, to point us to that other country, our true country. So let's look at how Lewis tries to do that in Prince Caspian. If Prince Caspian is no Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, there's no shame in that. As we've already said, how could any story measure up to what, in fact, in Narnia is the greatest story ever told? It kind of gives you new appreciation, doesn't it, for Luke, the great gospeler. He had to come up with a sequel called Acts. How do you surpass the gospel of Luke? It's got tremendous teaching. It presents the person of Jesus. Well, that's what the book of Acts is. It's a sequel. And it does have very exciting stories and exploits, starting with Acts 2. And I know in a church like Calvary, Acts 2 is a really exciting event and important to who we are as believers. Lewis has the same problem as an author with Prince Caspian. How do you top Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? It's got the coming of Aslan, his death, his resurrection, and that coronation. Well, you know what? Prince Caspian tells us life goes on. All of you who are in this audience, blessed enough to call yourself a believer, know that as exciting, as wonderful as your conversion experience can be, you know what? There's a Monday morning coming up, and a Tuesday, and a Wednesday, and so on. Prince Caspian is about Monday morning. It's about the sequels in your life. It's about what happens next. Even with an ever after, there's an even after. And Prince Caspian, in its own way, is a story of what happens when the ever after, whether happily ever after or joyfully ever after, what happens when the knowledge that leads to the joy is forgotten or suppressed or denied? What happens to a culture? What happens to a civilization like Narnia's when the true king, Aslan, is pushed to the periphery, is put on the margins, is forgotten about, whose stories are no longer told or sung or lived? That's what Prince Caspian is about. It's Lewis's cautionary tale to any civilization sort of drunk on its own achievements about what will happen to it if and when its true foundations are disparaged and disintegrated, even on purpose. So the question is not how has life gone, but how can life go on that Prince Caspian is about. Now, related to that very important theme is the idea of mentoring in wisdom and righteousness. And whether we're talking about in Prince Caspian, the nurse who takes care of him, or later Dr. Cornelius, his designated mentor, it's very important to see that we need to have that spiritual company around us that not only introduces us to the story, but maintains the story, reminds us of the story, encourages us to believe the story. And in the opening pages of Prince Caspian, that's what's happened. There's been treachery in this household that just mirrors the treachery of the last 1,300 years, because that's how long it's been since the events of the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And so when the Pevensey kids are called back into Narnia, they find what? Ruins. They're looking for what? The remnant of faithful Narnians. Old Narnia. Now, when they get back, they don't realize there's an old and a new Narnia, because for them, it's just a year. They've been to school. They've done their arithmetic. You know, they've played their rugby. They're kings and queens. Where's their thrones? Where's Ker Perivel? Where's Aslan? This culture has become one that doesn't even know if Aslan ever existed. But you know, Caspian's like one of those few young kings in the book of 2 Kings and 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles. I had the privilege of speaking last Sunday at church, and I mentioned he's a lot like King Josiah in 2 Chronicles 34, who became King Josiah after having been Prince Josiah for only 8 years. He's a young king. But he restores Judah by finding the original book, the revelation of God, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of Josiah in Caspian. But here's this great line that Dr. Cornelius uses at the very beginning of the book to set the stage. Listen, he says to Prince Caspian, all you have heard about old Narnia is true. It is not the land of men. It is the country of Aslan, the country of the waking trees, the visible naiads, of fauns and satyrs and dwarves and giants, of gods and centaurs, of talking beasts. It's the Narnia of miracles. It's the Narnia of the fall, the great meltdown that allowed spring to come and Father Christmas to come and bring gifts and so forth. These sounded like fairy tales even to Prince Caspian, but Cornelius says they're not fairy tales. They're real. And when Caspian goes off, of course, in that midnight jaunt, because a child has been born that will be a rival to the throne, and he knows he's in danger, and Cornelius sends him off, he runs off to the woods, which he's always been told are full of ghosts. But they're not full of ghosts, they're full of Narnians. they're full of these faithful people in exile who've been keeping alive the knowledge of Aslan. And he, of course, makes common cause with them. What we learn in Prince Caspian is vantage point is crucial. Perspective is essential. And we learn that one is responsible for what one sees. Now, the Pevensey kids, Lucy and Edmund and Peter and Susan, they have a different circumstance than the old Narnians. They've come back thinking they've come back to the Narnia they know, Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, Mr. Tumnus, all those talking animals and so forth. They don't find any of them. Only Lucy looks for Aslan. Only Lucy sees Aslan at the beginning. Their problem is finding the old Narnia and having a place to stand. They know they've been called to Narnia for a reason. They just don't know what that reason is. It's different for the old Narnians who are hanging on to a thread of faith. And there are great skeptics in this culture. Trumpkin's one of them. And it's his grand journey from unbelief to belief that's on display. It mirrors a lot of Lewis. It's a very autobiographical work. And Lewis is in some ways skewering his own journey of faith and showing us how many ways God was trying to bring him to Christ through reason, through imagination, through experience. It's a lot going on in Prince Caspian. As I said at the beginning, timing is everything, and it's Aslan's timing. He will appear when he's ready to appear. And when he does, Lucy's there to see him because she's the pure heart. Aslan, said Lucy, you're bigger. That is because you're older, little one, answered he. Not because you are. I am not. But every year you grow, you will find me bigger. I just want to say, I wish they'd kept the line in the movie just like that. See, Aslan's stature grows as we grow because we begin to see how grand and majestic and kingly and authoritative and terrible, like Song of Solomon says, terrible as an army with banners. But this is a different time. And as Aslan does say in this same scene, nothing ever happens the same way twice. And so in this case, there's not going to be a grand sacrifice. There's no need to. That was once for all. But the community of faith needs to rise up and defeat unbelief and the evil King Miraz. King Miraz is evil for lots of reasons, but not the least of which is he has rejected the stories. Now, in that scene, just stay with this a couple more minutes. He kind of goes on, and Aslan himself gets a little impatient with Lucy. For a time, it says, she was so happy she did not want to speak, so Aslan spoke. Lucy, we must not lie here for long. I don't know about you, when I read this passage, I'm thinking about Mary Magdalene meeting Jesus in the garden. And he says, touch me not, I have not ascended to the Father. There's work to be done. We must not lie here long. You have work in hand, and much time has been lost today. That is a very subtle rebuke of Lucy. Because it was her job, upon seeing Aslan and knowing he was there, to rally her brothers and sister. And she tried. She was easily defeated. And Aslan doesn't want her to rationalize her behavior. And Lucy finally says, you mean, rather faintly, that it would have turned out all right somehow? It's kind of like, again, the book of Esther, like, for such a time as this, Esther, but if not, help will arise elsewhere. But please, Aslan, how am I to know? How would it have worked out if I'd gotten them here? And to know what would have happened, child, said Aslan, nobody is ever told that. Oh dear, said Lucy. But anyone can find out what will happen, Aslan says, if you go back to the others now and wake them up and tell them you've seen me again and that you must all get up at once and follow me. What will happen? There's only one way of finding out. Obey. That's how you find out. And she does. So Lucy and her kin also have a faith-building experience, a reminder of what it means to follow Aslan. And now they're ready to join this fellowship, if you will, this community of faith, and take on the evil spirits. But just as in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, there was a betrayer, a villain in the midst, Edmund in the former, there is one in this company, and it's a sad tale. It's this tale of Nicabric. One of the dwarves called Black Dwarves. Trumpkin is among the Red Dwarves. Dr. Cornelius is half-dwarf and half-human. There's a lot of species envy and species bigotry in this work that deserves some attention sometime when you're thinking about it. Nicabric is like those dwarves in the last battle who chant toward the end, if you know that work, the dwarves are for the dwarves. Very short-sighted, very narrow-minded, very selfish. It's Nicabric in Prince Caspian, the novel, who initiates the idea of a seance, of a bringing back the White Witch. He's rebuked immediately by Truffle Hunter, the valiant badger. But Nicabric is a doubter and a cynic. And he is so cynical, he says this, all said and done, none of us knows the truth about the ancient days of Narnia. Aslan and the kings, they go together. Either Aslan is dead or he is not on our side or something else stronger than himself keeps him back. And if he did come, how we'd know he'd be our friend. Anyway, he was only in Narnia once that I ever heard of, and he didn't stay long. You can just drop Aslan out of the reckoning. I was thinking of someone else. Nicabric has gone so far that he's willing to accept anything or anybody as a solution to the oppression of Narnia. I'm talking about the witch, he says. We want power. We want a power that will be on our side. And as for power, do not the stories say that the witch defeated Aslan and bound him and killed on that very stone which is over there just beyond the light? Well, that's a half-truth. And half-truths, just like they do in our world, they get you in trouble in Narnia. He keeps going, this militant unbelief. Yes, they say. But you'll notice we hear precious little about anything Aslan does afterwards. He just fades out of the story. Think about this. He fades out of whose story? The culture story. He hasn't faded away anywhere. He's still there. They're the ones who have left him behind. They say the White Witch ruled for 100 years, 100 years of winter. There's power, if you like. There's something practical. It's sort of like poor Edmund, who, when he's thinking about, after he's had some of that Turkish delight, when he's king of Narnia, he'll build better roads. You know, Mussolini wanted the trains to run on time, and Edmund wants better roads than Narnia. They don't even know what they're saying. Nicabrick doesn't know what he's saying. Well, the old Narnians, the faithful Narnians, they overcome him. And it's a sad tale. But it is a cautionary tale for us, an application on every hand as we think about it. In The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, faithful Narnians faced perpetual winter. In Prince Caspian, they faced spiritual amnesia, where there's no knowledge, the people perish. The final trustworthy story of Prince Caspian is to be written by the faithful followers of Aslan, Dr. Cornelius, King Caspian, Reepicheep, my favorite character in all of the Chronicles of Narnia, the four Pevensies. This is the story that must be told again and again, but more importantly, in Narnia, it's the story that must be lived. And that's the tale of Prince Caspian. Now, let me just branch over and talk a bit about the movie. And let me say two things. First of all, close your ears if you haven't seen the movie. or if you don't mind hearing something about the movie, you know, stay put. But how many actually have seen the movie of Prince Caspian? Okay, pretty good number, but not everybody here. How many of you intend to see the movie? Okay, almost all of you. What can I say? On the previous slide, I have my C.S. Lewis website. It's easy to remember. It's cslewisblog.com. And I published my review of the movie there Friday morning. I'd seen a midnight showing Thursday night, and I was already in a cranky mood, so that probably doesn't help with the tone of this review. But let me say a few words about it. In some ways, it's a perfect summer movie for an American audience. Like, although I didn't like it, it's sort of like Transformers. Lots of action. Lots of tension. What's going to happen? Some romance. Not particularly chaste, I would say. Prince Caspian has some of those elements. And so you'll enjoy it probably as a movie, though it's very long, I think, 2 hours and 40 minutes. Maybe if you don't see it at midnight, it doesn't play so long. You tell me. I think if you spend 2 hours and 40 minutes in Narnia, you ought to come out refreshed and excited and have a sense of joy. If you spend 2 hours and 40 minutes in William Wallace's Scotland, like in Braveheart, or you spend it in Peter Jackson's Middle Earth in any of the three movies made of The Lord of the Rings, if you spend it, and I don't know that anybody here would, but if you spend it in Harry Potter's Hogwarts, even if you spend it in Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, the chances are you're going to come out kind of sullen, dark, sad. I wanted to spend 2 hours in Narnia. I got to spend about 15 minutes in Narnia. you know, whenever Reepicheep is on the screen, whenever Aslan is on the screen. There are a lot of neat things in the movie, and I won't spoil those by pointing them out to you, but there's some things missing. And I'll just tell you two of them. One is the theme that I already talked to you about, the theme of why is Narnia troubled? Is it just because they have an evil king? You know what? There are evil kings even to this day. They are all over the earth, and someday they will bow the knee. But right now, there's plenty of evil kings. And evil kings, they're selfish, and they want to preserve their kingly line and so forth. So that is a plot element. Yeah, that's logical. But it doesn't explain how 1,300 years of Narnia have led to this. And that theme is not really in the movie. And I wouldn't say that would be an easy theme to present. But it could be suggested. It could be part of the give and take of Dr. Cornelius and so forth. So I miss that. The other thing I miss, and actually what makes me feel most negatively about the movie is that Nickabrick really is an apostate. He really is somebody who has lost his way, lost his faith. And he's the one who instigates this desire to call up the White Witch. And that's true of Lewis's novel. Unfortunately, it's not true alone in this movie. The movie depicts this temptation to follow the White Witch as really part of several key characters' own temptation. And I think that's a mistake, because it's hard to depict goodness in any situation, because goodness always seems trite and so forth. But in this movie, we need the blacks and the whites, the eternal truths and the temporary untruths, to be very well lit. And it seemed to me that the movie gets off the rails toward the end. I look forward to there being a Voyage of the Dawn Treader as long as Reepicheep doesn't morph into Mickey Mouse. And with that, I will stop and thank you for your attention. Chad, can I turn things over to you? Thank you again. Absolutely. And maybe I'll see you out at the table.
Fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Edwards, for your thoughts and your time tonight. A couple of thoughts. Your website, which I think was on that initial slide, is cslewisblog.com. So I'd encourage you to check it out with a great review of the movie from Dr. Edwards' perspective, and would help to follow up even on the comments tonight. And so cslewisblog.com. And then, does your son have a website with regards to his...
It's called justinkenya.com.
Okay, Justin Kenya. His first name is Justin. Or sounding like he got there just recently. So justinkenya.com. And that's the information on the proceeds there. Okay, Justin Kenya. So there's some information there. Thanks again for coming out tonight. In fact, Dr. Edwards, why don't I let you go ahead and head out to be at the table. If you'd like to get some more information, or maybe take a look at his book, maybe even purchase a copy and have it signed by the author tonight, this is a great opportunity. Thanks again for being here tonight. I hope it was beneficial for you. Have a great night.